Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 302. I am Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Live long and prosper.
Oh, yes. And Julio Ojeda Zapata.
Good morning.
And our buddies Graham Thickens and Phil Wilson opted not to be on this morning. They've got other things going on, and I think part of it is one of them is becoming a tech writer for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Oh, no. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. No, that's what you do, Julio.
Yeah, don't make me paranoid or anything.
How's it going, by the way? Do people just send you stuff?
My role at the as a tech writer at the Pioneer Press has evolved a little bit. I'm more of a business tech writer, and I do a lot of reporting on tech activity in the Twin Cities. I don't do quite as much tech testing. I do some tech testing on a freelance basis for some other folks, but I don't do a whole lot of that for the Pioneer Press anymore.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Yep.
Gotcha. Well, we should
Is the gadget coverage, Julio, going to sort of AP and other kind of national sort of stuff? Is that where they're getting the tech coverage now for the gadgets?
Well, the paper doesn't run a whole ton of gadget news. I've been doing a crap ton of writing for Tidbits, which is an online, very very well known and very long lasting Macintosh Apple publication, kind of an online venue for Apple news. And I've lately been writing a ton of stuff for them. So I've been doing a lot of gadgety stuff, mostly Apple gadgety stuff for them. Yeah, I've also been doing some writing for Macworld.
I enjoyed your review of the Sling TV over there.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
That was good.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anything else happen this week, Phil? I mean, Scott or Steve?
Well, the only other thing that there's been so many things happening, but the story that we need to probably start off with is the FCC voting in favor of making internet service providers a common carrier, and so they'll have oversight now on net neutrality. So I thought that was a big story.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge story.
And a big, big surprise, because it didn't seem like things were moving that direction at all. And people sort of got really hardcore on Tom Wheeler because they thought he was kind of industry patsy. And it was very interesting how he completely did a 360, and things turned out, you know, better than proponents of net neutrality could have hoped. The only problem now is this thing is gonna hit the courts. You know, the powers that be are gonna drag this thing into court. So this thing could be a very long story. But you know, the initial step here is very promising.
Yeah.
Well, I've been against this for a while and remain against this, and I think it's going to really be bad on innovation on the internet. And as a side benefit, I think that this is exactly what Wheeler and the cable companies wanted. There will be very few, new providers that will be coming. The only one that I'm hoping is Google. And the only reason is that Google doesn't make any money on their access. They make money on advertising. So, but if you're just looking at the way that this is going to be regulated like a utility, I mean, how many different electric companies do you have and water companies do you have? And how much control do you have over their pricing? So we'll have fewer providers of the service, and I think that the prices will be higher. And this is not to mention all the regulations for the content that will be happening on the internet, which having the government regulate content, I think, is a bad idea.
See, I think it'll be the opposite. I think that I don't think there'll be any content regulation. That it'll be really focused on making the playing field stay level.
Yeah, Tim, I don't understand. You'll have to forgive me. Everything you said, I don't really understand, because I think the whole point here is that if you just say, okay, guys, this is a pipe, everybody going through this pipe can move at the same speed. I think that that's a good thing, because otherwise we get into a situation where, you know, depending on how much you can pay, that sort of determines how quickly you can move down that, that pipe. And that, that seems fairly cut and dried. I don't know how that would, impede innovation. Although, I'll make an additional point. I don't think this by itself is going to create a golden age of innovation. I think this is a good first step, but other things need to happen. And in fact, the FCC did one other thing, which was to sort of signal that it is inclined to preempt state laws that, you know, prevent municipalities from setting up their own broadband networks. That is an additional step it took above and beyond net neutrality, and I think those additional steps are needed. I don't think this specific situation just by itself is going to make everything hunky dory for the internet. I think there's some other you know very concrete steps that I believe the government needs to take to sort of encourage competition and so forth. But I think they've laid a groundwork here that is necessary and promising.
Well, as a libertarian, I believe in very low government intervention in business and with just about everything, except for national defense and some other things. And so I just don't like the idea of any kind of regulation. And I disagree with you, Steve, that I think there will be regulation by the FCC. On content, because that's exactly what they do with radio and broadcast television right now, is they regulate the kind of type of content that's there, and they'll do the same thing on the internet, because that's what these bureaucrats do. So that's the real problem I have with this, is that having the government determine what happens on this international resource is really problematic. The other point to Julio, to your issue, the internet has never been neutral, ever. It's always been set up in a way where if you use a bandwidth in one direction higher than in the other direction, you pay for that access. You pay for taking that, you know, that information. It's called transit. You know, and transit agreements, I think, are going to be interesting how the court determines that, because it isn't neutral. And if the transit agreements are thrown out, then you're going to see Netflix hampered dramatically because of all the transit that they won't be able to purchase for their customers. If you haul data in both directions equally, then you have a peering agreement where there's no money really changes hands. You just say, okay, I'll handle your traffic if you handle mine. And that happens routinely. Well, so that's where it is neutral.
Can I interject real quick on that one?
Yeah.
Because you like your Roku, right?
Yep.
And I like my new Roku. Now I have Apple TVs and a Roku. And I am, in fact, paying for a Comcast business class connection. Because I need the turnaround. I need people to be here in 4.5 hours, but also because there's no bandwidth caps right now on business.
Well, and you run your business out of your house.
Correct. Too. And, right. And so the one thing about the bandwidth caps is that had net neutrality not won, if it had been defeated, then the caps could have come back and Comcast and Time Warner and other internet service providers that also provide cable television, and it's almost half of Comcast's revenues, by the way, they would have been in a position to say to all of the streaming video providers, all of them, including the tiny ones, that you have to pay to have your stuff streamed. Otherwise you can't. And oh, by the way, customer, you have to pay now for tiered service. So if you're using 300 gigs a month, then that's your ceiling. That's as much as you can have. If you want to use 500 gigs, sorry, you're going to have to pay double.
Well, this is exactly where we're headed right now with Title II. Exactly. If you use more electricity or water today, you pay more. You're going to pay more for that bandwidth. I guarantee it.
Yeah, but Tim, and you raised the sort of the specter of content, the government sort of getting into content control. what the conversation that we've been having right now is a different one, the one that Steve has pointed to, which is basically speed, not being able, not being capped, not being impaired in terms of performance. You're right that in this country, there has been an unfortunate trend in many cases of the government sort of trying to determine, you know, what kind of content is permissible and so forth. That is sort of the next conversation. That is something that has always happened. I suspect will always happen. And it's a battle that needs to be fought continually. But I don't think what happened should not have happened on the grounds that you're talking about, because you're basically changing the conversation. This is not what has been discussed until now. It's more of a performance issue, not a content issue.
Yeah. Well,
if you read the regulations though, they talk about lawful content all the time. So the government determining what is lawful on the internet is a change in policy.
Yeah, but that is a battle and a conversation yet to come. And it's, yeah,
no, I think it's another part of this which makes it a bad idea.
That's a copyright centric discussion. But we could spend a whole show on this. So let's move on. All I have to say is just one last thing. I'm going to get the last word on this because I'm controlling the audio, is that I really like the fact that my fruits and vegetables aren't being sprayed with DDT. I like the fact that I can turn the tap on and there's regulation to make sure that my water's clean. And I like the fact that somebody with a new Dodge Challenger RT or whatever the hell that new one is that has like a 600 horsepower engine can't do 200 miles an hour down 494. So I like the fact that there are regulations. It depends on whether they affect you or not. But at any rate, the next big story that happened in Minnesota was Phil Sorin's company, Phil and a couple of other guys that spun off some technology from the University of Minnesota called VidCo. And I really want to get my hands on this. The product is called Flipgrid, and we'll put a link in the show notes. And it's essentially, a teacher can start a conversation and then students can chime in with their video responses. And I see great opportunity for this in business, and I see incredible opportunity for one of the startups that I'm advising and just to use it as technology. What do you guys think? Have you looked at this at all?
No, I just saw this story and I put it in because we've been talking about what Phil has been doing.
Yeah.
How is this different from other messaging apps?
Well, there have been a lot of apps that let people sort of have conversations by, lobbing little videos at each other. I'm not fully understanding how this is any different.
Well, it's the way that it's hosted as a grid, and then the questions are all part of it. And there's all sort of sorting and filtering as part of it. I haven't actually used it, so I don't really know. I couldn't answer all those different questions. The only thing that I don't like about it is that it still leverages Flash right now.
Interesting.
So,
Why would you do that?
Well, for the browser-based version, if you're using a mobile device, it doesn't. But so that's not good. But anyway,
yeah,
I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. We'll keep an eye on this one.
Yep. Well, they could have been using Silverlight, so.
Yeah, they could have been.
Yeah, I guess it could be worse.
Is that totally dead, by the way? Silverlight from Microsoft?
No, I don't think so. Well, it's still around here and there.
Is it?
When you install Netflix on a Windows PC, they still ask you to install Silverlight.
Oh. Yeah, because the Netflix streaming thing is based on Silverlight still.
But speaking somewhat generally, since I haven't played with this technology, I think it's vital that innovation occur in how students and teachers, over internet connections can communicate with each other. Because I think that whole thing is very primitive, and I don't think online education is really going to take off until these specific technologies are really nailed down. Skype certainly isn't going to cut it. FaceTime isn't going to cut it. I think. These sorts of things need to happen to sort of advance the art of online communication in educational settings. So anything like this, I certainly applaud.
Yeah. Yep. And then in another development, Torrey Hunter, the former Twin, or is he? No.
He came back.
Yeah, he came back. I was just going to say, he's not a former Twin.
Well, he was former, but right, he's right, coming right. back to, I think that this is his last season or close to his last season.
Yeah. But he's
good to see him throwing some money around town.
Yeah, he's raised $1 million from investors, and they're going to do various venture investments here. So that's cool.
Yeah,
and
his this iMine product is a retail online retail product. So it'll be interesting, or I guess it's an app. Interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I wrote a story about that. Let me see here. That was back in late November, and I thought it was kind of interesting. It's basically a scenario where if you buy things, you know, through iMine, they sort of kick back money over to charities. And over Christmas, you know, they had a promotion where every day they would designate a different retailer, you know, such as Toys R Us or PetSmart or Nike. And on that particular day, you know, if you made a purchase, then money would be thrown over to a charity that I believe you can designate. It's an interesting business model.
Well, you know, that's the same business model that Bill Veneman, the former Target guy, I wrote an article in July of 2013 about Go Buy Local.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Veneman had started that. It was exactly the same business model.
Yeah.
I mean, you always wonder why certain startups actually take off. Like, why did Instagram be the one, even though there were like six other camera apps that did essentially the same thing? Why did they win? Makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
I'm not getting a sense for how well iMine is doing in this Torrey Hunter thing. Maybe an effort to sort of raise visibility.
That could be. So, Tim, did you put this in here?
I did about
the Anthem data breach. I did not know this. 300,000 Minnesotans were affected.
You may be one of them, Steve.
Not a chance.
Oh, no. You're not? Okay. Good.
No, I'm totally secure.
Oh, excellent.
No, I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know if I am or not.
Yeah, so, I guess it
because we are covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. So
Yeah.
So are we at Pennsylvania. So I got a little nervous there.
Yeah. Well, they said they're less than 1% of their members. But I am going to call.
300,000 families are not going to be happy here.
Right. So, well, it would be nice if they'd put something online so you could do a quick lookup to see if your name's in there.
Yeah, it would be nice.
But they do have an 800 number to call, established by Anthem. So if you want to see if you're affected, you can call that number. And so that's a positive, I guess. Oh, man.
Well, so if you can understand the guy on the other end, that is, you know.
Right. Well, if he's from Eagan or, God forbid, Lakeville, you probably can understand him because he doesn't speak the King's English. So,
right. Well, I know Julio had some run-ins this week for some call center folks. I'm reading his tweets.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
I just couldn't understand him. Apparently.
Yeah, I get a little annoyed when somebody at a call center picks up and their mastery of English is a little iffy. Their accents are so thick that I can't understand them. And I don't care where they are. I have nothing against international call centers. I don't care if they're in Brazil or Michigan or I really don't care about that. I just want to be able to have a conversation that's intelligible, and it all too often that's not the case. So
right.
Yep.
Well, all right. So there's a couple of stories in here too about Target. Their digital sales growing more than 30% in 2014.
Yep.
That's a surprise.
Yeah. Well, they've been devoting more effort online, so that's not terribly surprising, but it's $3 billion of their sales is now online, which that was the part that kind of surprised me.
Right.
And they're really going gangbusters with mobile too. They've been very aggressively, very quickly upgrading, you know, their apps and so forth. Their their main store app has some really fantastic mapping capabilities. And then you go into the store and you can pull up a store map and it can sort of point you to the specific things that you want. It's really cool.
You know, I have yet to see anybody really take steps to try to essentially pay people to shift their behavior. If you remember when Northwest Airlines wanted to dump all their travel agents because they were paying them 10% commission, that they essentially told the world, if you book online, we'll give you 2,000 bonus miles. And if you started to use their online reservation system, and I got to tell you that just about everybody did an immediate about face, and they changed behavior. They basically bought people's behavior. And I'm surprised that Target hasn't done more of that. You know, yeah, you can make it attractive and you can have good pricing and all of that and in-store pickup and, you know, all the things that you think now are table stakes to be in the brick and mortar / e-commerce space. But there really hasn't been a great effort on, if you really want something new and hot, if you buy it online, you'll be first and you'll get it for a lower price, or, you know, really to take steps to change behavior. Or don't you think do you think that's important, Tim?
Yeah, of course it is. They need to be competitive with other retailers in their space. And one of those is obviously Walmart, that made some news a couple weeks ago with their raising of their minimum wages.
Yeah.
And it looks like, from what I'm seeing from Bring Me the News, that Target's not going to follow suit, which I think is kind of a problem. They're gonna have problems maintaining those entry-level employees, because it looks like many other retailers are raising their minimum wages.
Well, although what we don't know is whether Target pays employees more than Walmart does. I have a hunch that
they don't.
They don't.
Yeah.
They
just listened to an NPR story about it.
Yeah.
So
they don't now. They haven't. And now they're going to be, you know, a wider disparity. So I think that's a real problem.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we'll see. You know, we'll give Brian Cornell benefit of the doubt here. But I think it's going to be a real issue for them maintaining, you know, the kind of employees that they want to maintain their brand, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but at some point now, with smartphone paying and RFID and everything else, you won't need humans. You know, and we'll have robots that stock the shelves. And
one of the things that's surprising about Target is that they haven't jumped on board of these self-checks like Walmart and other stores. You know, Home Depot, you can go there and with your 2x4s and check out by yourself if you want.
Yeah.
They haven't done that.
Target?
Yeah, Target.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, you can? Okay. Well, the stores down here, they don't have those. So, okay. Well, I'll throw my point out. I think that their personal service is part of their brand, and this is where it's going to really fall down, I think.
I may be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure you can do that at some Target stores. I may be wrong. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I just haven't. All the stores that I shop down here south of the river, they don't have that. You have to wait for a team member to check you out.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a Minneapolis mom that launched a design-it-yourself website for handmade kids' clothing.
This is a brilliant idea, I think, because of, you know, the especially millennial moms, that they want these handmade, you know, artisanal types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you scale a business like this?
Yeah, it's not very scalable at all.
It's not, no.
Yeah. I guess you could get a factory somewhere, you know, and Central America or someplace,
yeah.
and you could automate this in some way, you know, but yeah, the scaling is an issue, but I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So you pick the basic design, then you mix it, and then they make it.
Yeah.
And so
it's about picking the fabrics and mixing and matching the fabrics together.
But see, I think that's a brilliant idea because of just what you said about being able to potentially at some point outsource it, where the orders could come in and they could turn them around quickly and ship them back.
But can you make, in a factory setting, like that? Can you make a custom product quickly to satisfy lots of demand?
Well, it depends what you mean custom. If you set up a system where you have some a number of predetermined choices.
Well, they do. And she has five. She has five choices on here. You know, for that, well, two T-shirts and three dresses.
But how many permutations of all of the different fabrics are there? It's probably thousands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, but so, you could have all the inventory of the fabrics and just be able to quickly mix and match them. I don't know. I just think it is a fun idea.
I mean, you have companies like Timbuktu, which make messenger bags and a whole variety of designs, and you can design them on the website. And that activity, as I understand it, is not even outsourced overseas. It's done right in the United States. So there certainly is precedent for that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a cool idea. Who found that? Did you find that?
Yeah, I did.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I like that.
So now we have a Julio block of some of your work this week. Let's start with that 3D home tour deal.
Oh yeah, that was kind of a fun story. There's a company out of Silicon Valley called Matterport, and they've come up with a camera that is kind of ingenious. It's sort of a multi-lens camera that you put on a tripod and you push a button, and the camera just basically spins around and sort of visually photographs its surroundings in a 360 thing. And it's used by real estate agents, because real estate agents can go into a house and put down the camera, do a 360, then move the camera slightly, do another 360. Then they do this about several dozen times. And the end result is a very, very high quality, very realistic walkthrough of the house. There's basically kind of a little video thing embedded on your website. And you can it's a little bit like Google Street View.
It's awesome. I'm playing with it right now. We'll put a link in the show notes so people can.
And Google has done something like this. I forget what it's called, Google Business Photos. They've tried to set up a system where they outsource this to specialized photographers that come into your business and sort of do the same thing, do kind of a visual walkthrough. But if you compare Matterport and the Google thing, the Matterport is vastly more sophisticated, vastly higher quality. The uses HDR photography, and the end result is stunning. The Matterport, this technology has a lot of potential applications, but Matterport has sort of focused on the real estate industry. And in my research, I've perceived that real estate agents are absolutely going bonkers over this thing. A buddy of mine, John Linden, is a realtor here in St. Paul, and when he found out about this thing, he went absolutely nuts, and he teamed up with a childhood buddy of his who's a photographer, and they're actually starting a new company to create these walkthroughs for other real estate agents. Realtors are really, really latching onto this thing in a big way.
Well, I put a link in here to Architect 3D, which is a architecture software company that has really gone crazy with this, and they've got a high-end house, and they've got this 612 Brew Company restaurant, and you can start to see the potential here.
Yeah, I actually interviewed that company for my story, and they do a similar kind of thing. They use the Matterport technology to sort of capture businesses. They did a brewery and so forth. And that company is interesting in itself, because their whole emphasis is 3D capture and modeling and so forth. And they use the Matterport technology, but they use a whole bunch of other technologies. That company is someone I might look at a little more closely, because they're doing a bunch of interesting stuff. But they have also latched on this Matterport thing. They're as part of sort of the real estate industry. They're also doing the same thing. They're sort of outsourcing their imaging services for real estate agents that don't want to buy their own camera. This camera costs $5,000, so not every real estate agent will want to buy one. But all these companies in the Twin Cities are springing up to sort of offer the service for a fee to real estate agents who want these 3D walkthroughs on their listings.
Yeah, makes total sense.
Yep.
But we have to cut to the chase here and get to your virtual reality stories.
Oh yeah.
So this is why don't you go ahead and set it up and what the company, what the technology is, and so on.
Well, virtual reality is, as many people know, are the basically these goggles that you put on, and the goggles typically use a smartphone that's inserted into the goggles as kind of the brains and the interface. And if you're looking at the right kind of content on the smartphone screen, what you perceive in on the goggles is basically an immersive environment, which is not just a screen in front of you, but it's basically an environment where you can look up, down, left, right, down, to the rear, and it can be anything. I was using goggles to basically sit in a Mongolian yurt and sort of look around and see families, you know, having a good time with each other. But the main story that I did this week is about virtual reality in the Twin Cities. My buddy Chuck Olson, who has a background in video and has a background in sort of interactive content, he and several other people started a virtual reality company. They're basically developing content such as social media apps, games, that are sort of virtual reality. And they launched this company. They told me about it. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I decided, you know, who else in the Twin Cities is doing fun virtual reality stuff? So I kind of looked around, and I found out that Space 150, a very clever local ad agency, has done. One of their clients is Polaris, and they set up this interactive exhibit at a motorcycle show where people could sit on a Victory Gunner bike and put on the Oculus goggles, and they could actually, you know, go down the highway, virtual highway in South Dakota while, you know, sitting on the bike in this convention hall. And I thought that was extremely cool.
Yeah.
And I checked out some stuff at the University of Minnesota. I found out has a virtual reality lab where they have these clunky goggles that are not ready for prime time commercially, but they use a iPad mini as their interface. And what's cool about those is up to six people can be using the goggles at the same time. And the goggles are all communicating with tracking cameras overhead, which allows for precise locations. And the various people using the goggles can actually interact with each other in virtual space. So I thought that was extremely cool. So I basically consolidated all this virtual reality activity into one story, which turned out very well.
Yeah, that's great.
The only problem is with VR, I've discovered that I'm sort of susceptible to nausea, so I can only do this for a short period of time before I start getting a little queasy.
Well, you wouldn't have that problem if you had a holodeck. See, I had to get that in, Tim.
You did? Well and, played, sir.
Yes, and unfortunately, the original Star Trek did not have a holodeck.
It did not.
And our pal Leonard Nimoy unfortunately passed away. At the age of 83, he had COPD, the lung issue that you get from smoking, and it finally caught up with him. And so that was pretty sad.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. There was an ad that he did with the young man whose name escapes me who played Spock in the Star Trek reboot.
Zachary Quinto?
Yes, and it was an Audi ad, where Nimoy is driving a Mercedes and he's trying to get his golf clubs in there. And
it's a fun ad.
It's a fun ad. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. He had a good sense of humor about it. He finally came to accept the fact that he was seen first as Spock, no matter what he did, no matter where he went. Even though, Tim, I saw that you stuck a link in the show notes to something that he did that I didn't even know about, called Nimoy's Nudes. He was a shutterbug, and he shot, or he did a, did he do like a coffee table book?
Where he that was did, my, that was, you're referring to a blog post that I wrote.
Yeah.
The blog post refers back to a 1997 story that I wrote about Scott Bourne. You guys remember Scott Bourne?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, Scott Bourne, local tech entrepreneur who used to live in the Twin Cities, but he was also a big-time photographer. And he buddied up with Nimoy, who at the time was also an accomplished photographer. And Bourne got a lot of Nimoy's photography online for the first time back in the days when we were talking about the World Wide Web. Yeah. And Nimoy, I found out he photographed black and white nudes, and he was very good at that. One of his approaches was to take photographs of women who are rounder, you know, they're chubby and so forth, and sort of take pictures of them and sort of extolling their beauty. And they would have a bunch of these women, you know, dancing around and having fun and
well, really really celebrating them as people rather than
exactly very interesting, yeah. Very, very interesting. Yeah. I actually interviewed Nimoy for that story that I wrote way back then. And that was an, you know, just
you
talking
did.
Nimoy was an honor. Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. How much time did he spend with you?
We had a phone conversation, which was kind of fun. I also crossed paths with Nimoy briefly in 2007 when I covered a Star Trek convention when he and Shatner, it was kind of rare for he and Shatner to do joint appearances, but they did one in downtown Minneapolis that year. And I covered that, and that was kind of fun. So having, you know, over the course of my journalism career, having crossed paths with Nimoy from time to time was always kind of a blast. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Very cool. Well, I also this morning found in my news feed, I love Sharpie's historical photos. So I get this mm-hmm. news feed from them, and it was a shot of black and white of Nimoy on the set of Star Trek. And he's standing mm-hmm. next to Forrest DeKelly, Bones, Dr. McCoy. And it's kind of an interesting shot of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing that he created this role, which didn't have really a precedent before it. And it was such a positive role.
Yeah.
And still affects, you know, the way that science fiction is performed outside of Star Trek today. So it's an amazing job that he did that I don't think that he gets a lot of credit for.
Right. Right.
And the other thing about Nimoy, I think I've had sort of brief exposures to him, and I always thought he was a very down-to-earth, very classy guy. That was the impression that I got, and hearing about other people talk about him, they sort of echo that. And he apparently, despite his fame, you know, was very, very, he had a very common touch, very interacting with fans. He was always very classy, very polite. That Star Trek convention actually stands out in my mind because I was standing in an auditorium where Nimoy and Shatner were sort of directly interacting with fans, and I was standing there watching these two guys, and the impression that I got, which has been echoed by many other people, was that Nimoy, he's a very classy guy, but that Shatner guy, he's kind of a jerk. And it was very obvious by the way they talked to fans. You know, Shannon was very condescending, or Nimoy, he really had a way of connecting with people, which I thought was remarkable.
Huh. Well, I think it's their egos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shatner has an enormous ego, and I think that he comes off as being kind of a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why that Saturday Night Live bit where he's at a Star Trek convention and he's like telling him to get a life.
Yeah.
Yelling it. I mean, that was actually, as rumor has it, that was his attitude toward these conventions.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, people, this was a short TV show. You know, rather than say, you know what, Shatner, if it hadn't been for that show, you know, you'd be doing bit parts and on CSI, you know? I mean, as a character actor.
Well, wait a minute, though. He was good in T.J. Hooker as well.
Oh, that was an awesome show. Critically acclaimed. Right. I actually didn't watch it much. It was a little too highbrow for me. Okay. So, oh my God.
All right. Follow up time.
Yeah. Hey, real quickly, did we talk about this, the NSA's
we did.
Sim heist last week?
So I stuck it in here. Yeah, we did.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So just another story about this. And what's funny is that, you know, they were just trying to go in and put, I guess, spyware on the SIMs.
Yeah.
To track all these phones. And it's very chilling, I think.
Well, because they broke into the company that
makes almost all of them.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, they've been trying to do that with routers and switches and things. They've actually been intercepting FedEx packages to plant these things. They basically want to get their eyes and ears onto the very infrastructure of telecommunications in such a way that people won't be able to perceive. It's very scary.
That it is.
Well, you know, and there have been stories that have come out this past week, one on Slashdot about its official NSA spying is hurting the U.S. tech economy. And, I mean, nobody trusts us.
Yeah.
I mean, Brazil is building their own fiber optic backbone undersea cable to Portugal so they can get to the continent.
Without having to go through the U.S. infrastructure.
Yep, so the U.S. infrastructure. Not that, you know, we couldn't send a sub down there and probably hack into it somehow, but still.
Well, the thing that really irks me about this story is that the name that they chose, their code name, Monkey Calendar. I mean, come on, really? Jeez, people.
What would you?
We're not a bunch of monkeys, are we?
What would you have called it?
I don't know, but not Monkey Calendar. That makes no sense.
I don't know.
I would call it Spectre.
Yeah, right.
Something good like that. You know, or Blofeld.
All right. So
Hydra.
Let's talk about something fun. So March 9th, the Apple event for the Apple Watch is going to happen.
Well, that's what they're saying. But, okay, I think that the watch is definitely going to be on the menu. However, look at that the graphic that they sent out, and that looks almost exactly like the NBC Peacock, you know, beginning thing from the 60s.
Mm.
I believe there's going to be an Apple TV involved in this.
Are you? Is that your nerd voice?
I don't know.
That is it. There will be an Apple TV.
Yeah, I think you're reaching, Tim.
Not a TV, an Apple TV like the Puck thing.
Sure. No, I'm hoping the 12-inch Retina MacBook Air will rear its head, too. That's a possibility.
Yeah. How about the iSlate, the extra big iPad? Really, of course, good. I think that 12-inch, right. I think that's going to be the device that's going to be the crossover device. So it's not going to be a standalone huge iPad. It's going to be an iPad that essentially it's going to be a Mac that runs iOS in some way. Because we know that's coming.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to really be that big of a deal, though. I'd rather see a device that's similar to a Surface where you can run both, where you can run both iOS and you can run macOS.
Yeah,
that to me would be very interesting. But I really doubt that Apple would do something like that. I mean, they're going to do a converged device at some point where we'll be running whatever, you know, Apple OS on the desktop as we will on the tablet and on the phone at some point.
Yeah,
but that'll be years away.
So I don't know about you guys, but one of the things about the Apple Watch is the more I read and the more I learn about the SDK for the Apple Watch and all the things that are going on, I keep thinking over and over and over again that this is not something I'm going to buy. And in some ways, I felt that way about the iPad. And it wasn't until I actually bought one and was sitting and reading it one day that I realized this totally changes the way that I interact with a computing device because it was quiet. There was only one thing in front of me rather than 57 windows with all kinds of tabs and apps running in the background, you know, lots and lots of visual noise and dissonance. There's only this one thing in front of me. And it materially changed the way that I interacted with stuff. So maybe,
you think you'll have an epiphany with the Apple Watch as well?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I mean, I won't know until I actually buy one and experience it.
Well, I think it's going to take a while. So the first generation, you know, the loyalists will go out and get them. But I think for it to really kind of become a big thing like the iPhone and the iPad have become and stand alone as its own device, it's going to take probably several generations before that happens. And I think the key is going to be its reliance on the phone. So if it can get away from the reliance on having the phone as its sort of a computing backend and do more stuff on its own, I think it becomes a more interesting device.
Well, the Apple Watch initially, as I understand it, will not run native apps. The only thing it'll do, it will only be an extension of apps that are on the phone initially.
Yeah.
And Apple has said, native apps that are 100% native to the phone are coming, but they won't be out initially. So there's going to be a whole, similar to what happened with the iPhone initially, they were just web apps, but later on there were native apps. Mm-hmm. So it's a similar thing with the iPhone. So we're sort of partway into the Apple Watch revolution as the device comes out, but then there's going to be this whole second stage that is already announced that is coming, but that's kind of down the road. And then stage three, as you noted, Tim, is perhaps a situation where the watch sort of becomes a standalone device and does not have a reliance on the phone at all.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see some obvious stuff like the ability to cache podcasts to the watch and then not have the phone to listen to them while you're running or exercising or whatever.
Yeah.
Stuff like that would be really nice, and like Overcast on the watch with your podcasts on them. I think that would be something that the watch could probably do right now, but Apple probably won't let you do it. They'll probably require you have the podcast streaming from the phone for at least the first generation.
Probably because it'll be a battery hog.
I imagine.
If you were running with a watch, you wouldn't have a wired headphone. You'd have a Bluetooth headphone, and now you got Bluetooth. Even with Bluetooth LE, it's still a battery use that's fair.
Well, speaking of watches, what do you make of the Pebble Color, whatever they call it, the Pebble Time that was announced this week?
Looks pretty awesome.
It does. It does.
If you watch the video, it's an e-ink, but it's color. But I was saying, okay, fine. It's a e-ink display that's color. Who the hell cares? But I looked, when you look at the videos, there's very sophisticated animation going on. There's a lot. It looks very, very sophisticated, but it's e-ink, which is a display that's on all the time. With the other watches, to save power, they have to go black, and then you have to sort of bring back the image when you want to use it. With this thing, it's the same as the old Pebble. The thing is on all the time, yet it's not a power hog, and you have I think it's a full 7 days of battery life.
That's what they claim anyway. Yeah.
And I was sort of feeling sorry for Pebble because I thought they were on their way out with things like the Apple Watch coming, but it seems I'm starting to see where there would be a definite place for them in the marketplace, a definite niche where they would be the lower cost device for people that don't want to splurge on these pricey Apple Watches and have a device that is extremely functional. I mean, the thing has a microphone, you can talk to it. The interface has been completely revamped. It's completely different, and apparently that's gonna transfer over to the old Pebble at some point. For the price, it's a surprisingly sophisticated device, and I think there's definitely going to be a place for it, especially since it's platform agnostic. It'll work with either Android or Apple.
Yeah, I think there's a huge market with us on the Android side that won't necessarily go with Android Wear. And there'll be other people with older iPhones that, don't want to have to have the latest technology to run the, the Apple Watch, which would imagine would be an iPhone 5 and higher or something like that, maybe 5S and higher.
I think it's 5S and higher, yeah.
Yeah. But this Pebble Time, they raised over $11 million in just, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. So it's still on Kickstarter. We have the link in the show notes. But
Original Kickstarter was kind of a record setter, and this is completely blowing that out of the water.
Yeah.
They matched their old record in just a few days. Yeah.
I think they may, because they have 27 days to go, they may sell, $20 million worth of these things.
Mm-hmm. That blows me away.
Which is amazing. And the problem that I see with this, though, is their industrial design is better than it was, but it's still, I don't know, a little clunky.
I actually like their older design better.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. You like the whatever the steel one, right?
No, I like the original.
The original.
It speaks to me for some reason. I just like it. I don't like the new one as much. Although it's thinner and it's a little more rounded to your wrist, apparently.
Well, this is the smartwatch that Steve Jobs would have never made because it has like four buttons on it.
Oh yeah. There's no touch screen.
Right.
But it needs a stylus.
No stylus required.
I gotta tell you, I'm really, really struggling with the whole idea of smartwatches generally, especially in the winter, because in the winter I'm wearing a long sleeve button down shirt and over that I have a sweater. So basically on my wrist, there are two layers of cloth it's a very clunky thing for me. I have to jam the watch under there and there's kind of a big, bump. And then when I want to use the watch, I have to sort of very awkwardly sort of pull back my sweater sleeve, pull back my shirt sleeve to get out the watch. The whole thing is, I'm just not getting how this is going to make my life any better. It just makes my life a lot more awkward. The whole idea of a smartwatch, perhaps in the summer when I'm wearing a short sleeve shirt, fine. But, you know, we're in Minnesota, for God's sake. We have like cold weather half of the year. And it just doesn't, it really doesn't work for me. I don't know how many other people feel the same way, but it feels very awkward, especially with the current generations of the smartwatches like the Moto 360 and the Apple Watch, which are very bulky.
Yeah. No, I don't see the utility of them either.
I don't get it at all.
You get all of the functionality from your smartphone today. So it just, to me, it's a product that's seeking a, you know, it's trying to solve a problem that's not, that people don't have. Plus, the only one that's making any kind of acknowledgement that a watch is jewelry is Apple with their probably $10,000 gold version. Just wait till the price comes out. People are going to freak out when they see the price.
Well, I'm going to buy two.
Yeah, it'll be at least $8,000. It'll probably be close to 10. And people are like, analyst I saw yesterday that thinks it's going to be $950. This thing is carved out of a solid block of gold. There's no way it's going to be $950.
It's going to be in the thousands for sure. Yeah. And there was an article about how the Apple Watch may in fact constrain gold supply around the world.
Oh, geez. Yeah. It's like when McDonald's started offering chicken McNuggets, all of a sudden, the chicken industry, there's like no chicken available.
I've tried to like smartwatches and it just flat out has not worked for me. I don't get it.
I think, Steve, it's time to unleash the beasts.
Oh no. The horse is out of the barn. Must be time for Steve's security tip of the week.
Jeez, I just love the machine gun fire. It's just a great addition.
Did you hear the horse fall at the end?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's the first time I've heard that.
All right. So, I just have to change it up a little bit. From time to time. Well, okay, so here's a security tip of the week. If you have a Mac, you know, we in the Mac world have always been laughing at our Windows counterparts who've dealt with crapware and malware for God knows how long. But now you can get in on this adventure too, and actually the tip is how not to be part of that adventure. Interesting article about Mac OS X isn't safe anymore. The crapware malware epidemic has begun. And here's what's interesting. I there's a guy that connected with me on LinkedIn that I met once and got an email from him with a bit.ly link and to some PDFs. And he was saying this is investment advice. I'm like, what? And so I ended up running the bit.ly link through a website that I go to. And it turns out that the PDF has a payload. And that payload could, in fact, if I'd opened the PDF, could, in fact, have infected my Mac. So I found that to be very interesting. That's really the first time that's happened to me, where I've had a payload that had something in it, malware that could have infected my Mac. Mm. What should you do? There's really, really four main things. One is obviously do backups so you can always roll back. Run your updates on OS X and your apps, so keep everything updated because there's security updates coming all the time. And then be very careful on installing free and other apps due to crapware. You know, the default in Mac OS X is in the security and privacy tab in preferences is to allow apps downloaded from the Mac App Store and identified developers. That's the default. And you can, if you want to be super careful so it won't run any executables from anything else, is only allow those apps from the Mac App Store. So if you have kids and you want to make sure that they're not doing anything to your machine, if you've got another account set up for them and so on, make sure that they can only download apps from the Mac App Store. That's it. And then don't open attachments from people you don't know. This used to be the advice I'd give to Windows people all the time, and now I have to do it with people running OS X as well, especially because of my own experience. So that's my tip of the week.
That's a good one.
This is why everybody should buy Chromebooks.
Yeah, that's right. True, actually, yeah.
Yeah, except for WebRTC now has leaks in it. That's the thing where you can do screen sharing and video within the
all right. Oh, dear.
The browser itself, yeah. So there's... I won't even get into that, but there's security leaks in WebRTC right now. But let's shift and let's talk about our cool things of the week. So, Tim, you get to go first, buddy.
All right. I've been using IFTTT, if, then, and that, for a long time. And it allows you to put together, you know, recipes of various actions and integrate various services, online services, together with your mobile devices and whatnot. This week, I got an email from them that they had some apps that they called Do, and there's three of them. There's a Do button and a Do photo and or Do camera and Do note. And what these do is allow you to, in a very simple interface, run some of these recipes. So, for instance, the ones that I've been experimenting with, or with the camera app, allow you to do things like capture receipts and send it to Evernote, which of course Evernote can then do some OCR on it if you're one of their premium subscribers, like everyone should be. And then you can do things like take a business card and you know, send it to Evernote, and it will, you know, be OCR'd as well. So stuff like that, I think, is very handy. And I'm experimenting with this Do button to try to get it to do various activities, like you hit a button and it will send a text to somebody or an email to somebody saying, you know, I'm late, I'll be there in a few minutes. Handy stuff like that. I think this has a lot of potential.
That's very cool.
Yep. So it's three apps, both iOS and Android.
You know, this could really give dedicated hub companies a run for their money.
Well, I think that, you know, I put this in there thinking of you, Steve, because you can run all of your home automation stuff using this Do button thing.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So you could have like a routine where you hit the Do button and it would, you know, turn on, you know, your lights in your house and, you know, open your garage door. I mean, you could do a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah. The only thing that I don't know, though, that I do know about SmartThings is I know a fair amount about their security model. And so even though the hub is set up to communicate with their server, the next version of the hub, Hub 2.0, is going to be one where you could set everything up and then unplug it from the internet, and it would still work in your house.
Oh, interesting.
And in IFTTT, I don't know what their security model is with respect to connecting to items in your house. And so I'll need to do some more investigation on that, but it's a cool premise.
Yep.
Very nice. Julio, do you have a cool thing?
Yeah. My buddy Chuck Olson, who's in VR, he lent me for a week the Samsung Gear VR, which is a full virtual reality rig that you can actually buy now at Best Buy for $200. You need to have the Samsung Galaxy Note 4 phone to sort of tuck in the device as an interface. But this is basically virtual reality that anybody can go to a store and buy now. And I spent a week with it, and it's remarkable. I mean, you could just you can do. I'll read you a paragraph from a blog post I wrote about this, about some of the things I did. I'm reading here. I stood on a rocky mountaintop jutting above the clouds and gaped at a sunset. I sat in a circular Mongolian yurt and saw a tender moment shared among family members. I took flight, attached to the underside of a helicopter as it came in low over a grassy plain with a huge herd of running horses. I experienced actual vertigo as I flew over Manhattan with the gleaming One World Trade Center passing off to my left. I did a whole bunch of stuff like that. And when you're wearing these goggles, you're basically in these worlds. Like, I was standing on stage right next to Paul McCartney as he was singing Live and Let Die. And I was standing in my home office, physically turning around to sort of see in this virtual world everything that was around me. I could look up, I could look down, left, that's right, cool. Down. It's the image quality is a little grainy, but if you get into one of these simulations that is really good, some of them aren't that great, but if you get into one that's really good, you're shocked at how you feel like you're actually there. My favorite one by far was standing in this Mongolian tent. I was sort of standing in the middle of it and looking around, and all these family members were just sharing a tender moment with each other and laughing, and the little kids were playing, and you really, really feel like you're there. And it's the first time I've really gotten excited about virtual reality. I've played with the Oculus Rift just a little bit, but having a full week with this rig was kind of a mind blower for me. Hmm. Yeah.
I'd like to have that amount of time with one. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
How much are they at retail?
$199.
$200, but you need, it doesn't work if you don't have the Samsung Galaxy Note 4, which is another $300.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's remarkable. I was in Tony Stark's lab. I was one of the drivers in a Jaeger in Pacific Rim. It was remarkable. Once you've done this for a while and you take the goggles off and you return to the real world, you feel disoriented, like there's something wrong. It takes a while for you to sort of get used to the real world again. So my mind was kind of blown, definitely.
Well, mine for the week is called iTrack, iTRAQ. It's an Indiegogo project.
Didn't you talk about this one last week?
No, did I?
I think you did. This is it's like a cellular tracking thing, right?
Yeah. Did I really?
You did, yes.
Okay, well, yep. Then I don't have anything.
No cool thing of the week.
I have no cool thing of the week. I thought I did not talk about it last week. I apologize.
Oh, so you did. That's all right.
Yeah, you know what? There, for the most part, there wasn't anything cool except for the fact. Well, you know what? I'll just tell about one thing that I actually did think was pretty cool. I have never been a big fan of page builders for WordPress really any web development at all, because it just doesn't look good. It doesn't function well and so on. And, there's a new one that's open source. It's free forever. It's called Layers, and I'll put a link in the show notes to it. And, it's a page builder that there are some commercial ones that are better and more fully featured, but, it is pretty interesting. And it's a page builder that you load as a plugin, and then you can do various layouts that before this required some fairly significant coding of registering widget areas, and then you have to define the CSS in each one so their layout is proper, and the, you know, blah 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 blah, and it takes all kinds of time to set up the architecture. And these page builders make it pretty doggone fast, and you can put together some pretty sophisticated pages that are responsive. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that. It's pretty cool.
What do you tell people if they ask you, what should I use, WordPress or Squarespace?
Well, it depends on what you want to do.
Well, it depends on what you want to do, but it also depends on the sophistication of someone. So Squarespace is absolutely fabulous if you want a really great looking site and you have very web page type needs. You know, if you don't need anything very sophisticated, or you don't need, hey, it'd be great to have events and appointments. Oh, hey, it'd be great to have sophisticated forms. Oh, it'd be great, you know. So you can't really grow it too dramatically. But if you just need a website and you also would like to be able to sell some stuff, even digital downloads, it's great.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's my cool thing.
I am going to check this out this week.
Excellent. How about upcoming events?
Not much has changed. We've of course have the Mobile March coming up, and what else?
Internet of Things, IoT Fuse.
IoT Fuse coming up here
March 19th. Wow, that's coming up. 19 days.
That's
pretty
right.
Fast.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to that. And of course, Mini Bar is coming up in April. So.
And still nothing on that in terms of registration or links. Not yet.
Nothing yet.
Yeah.
Ignite Minneapolis is coming up in April too.
Okay, good. Yeah. Let's get that in the show notes.
We'll have to add that. Are you speaking again, Julio?
The organizers have been trying to woo me into doing that, and my last go around was so incredibly scary that I'm trying to work up the nerve again. It's
okay. I saw the video of that.
It was terrifying. I'm not very big on public speaking, and Ignite type speaking is several orders of magnitude scarier than normal speaking, and so I'm on the fence about whether I'm going to work up the nerve to do this again or not. I do have a couple of interesting topics, so we'll see.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. A tip for you, Julio.
What's that?
Lots and lots of tequila.
Oh yeah.
Good. Well, all right, guys. Let's thank everyone for listening to another episode, and we'll see you next week on
the Minivate Gang Podcast.
Take care.
Have a good week.
Take it easy, guys.